Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Autism Stories. I'm your host, Doug Butcher, the founder of Autism Personal Coach. Autistic people are the true experts of the autistic experience, and Autism Stories is where we interview autistic people to learn from their stories, experiences, and get their insights. If you would like to be notified about each week's episode of Autism Stories, we suggest you subscribe on your favorite podcast listening platform. We would also appreciate it if you could give us a positive rating and review, as it will help others to learn about autism stories. Jamie Knight joins me on this episode to discuss the importance of play, digital accessibility, and the factors that lead to us all having great experiences in our lives. We hope you enjoy today's conversation. Jamie, thanks so much for joining me today.
You're welcome. Lovely to meet you.
And I wanted to start out our conversation by learning, where does your story in the autistic community begin?
That's a good question. I guess it really took off in my kind of late teens and early 20s. I had my, as with a lot of folks, my diagnostic journey was a bit of an adventure with a bunch of stuff when I was a kid and a bunch of stuff going on into my teenage years. I used to be on some various online forums. And then, yeah, in my late teens and early 20s, I started being quite active on Twitter and doing lots of talks and events. And that kind of all got started with my OT when I was 17, who invited me to go and do a talk alongside her at an event for other OTs. And then it all just kind of spiraled from there. So, yeah, it's been a while.
Now, you use your expertise and experience in digital accessibility and inclusive design to support organizations to build better products and services. What are some important things you try to communicate to organizations to be more accessible with their products and services?
I suppose I need to kind of start at the most basic level, really, which is the way that I approach accessibility is the barriers approach to accessibility based on the social model of disability. So the way that I kind of think about it and talk to my clients about it is that we have the concept of disability. So disability has like the medical lens where, you know, someone gets diagnosed with a disability, but there's also the social model. So the social model is the idea that we experience disability when there's a mismatch between us and our environment. And that mismatch comes in the form of barriers. So for me, one of those barriers will be things like terrible audio design in public spaces. That's a barrier that goes on to disable me. So that's known as the social model of disability. And it's a really core part of kind of how I approach everything I do. But then the second part is where do the barriers come from? So barriers lead to exclusion or they lead to workarounds. But what drives the barriers? And when I'm talking to clients, sometimes people think it's laziness or lack of something. But the way I tend to see it is the assumptions we make about other people that drive those barriers. So when I'm working with a young designer in their early 20s, they make the assumption that everybody else has the same vision they do. So they end up designing things with little tiny, teeny, weeny text, right? Because they have an assumption that they're not aware they have. To put it in a pithy phrase, I say that we encode the assumptions we make about others into the things we create in the form of barriers, whether that's the things we're designing, developing, how we structure society, you know, at a big picture, it's the assumptions that drive exclusion through the barriers. So that's a lot of what I end up working with clients on. So it could be big strategy stuff, it could be working with teams, and then I work across, you know, AAA games, VR stuff, or XR to give it its more proper name these days, as well as web, mobile, and stuff like that. So yeah, it's been a busy old couple of decades doing that sort of thing.
You have 20 years experience building digital products, but from what I understand, you focus on adventure and play in the digital space. What types of things do you bring in that focus on adventure and play?
Okay, so this phrase is a kind of fun one because it takes a little bit more storytelling before we get to it. So a question back to you, Doug. Kind of, as you have talked to so many different people, how has your kind of understanding of neurodiversity changed over time?
It's changed dramatically over time because I, you know, by talking to so many people, I learn about each person's lived experience and how my lived experience as an autistic person might be different than yours versus so many other people's.
Okay, so one of the hallmark moments for me, a moment that I can point at and go, oh wait, that's interesting, is the first time I ever spoke to Judy Singer. So I was chatting to her about coming to do some stuff for the BBC a couple of years back now, and she said like the four or five scariest words you can ever be asked by someone whose work you respect, where she was like, have you read my book? And I was like, not directly, but I know what it's about from, you know, everything I've read and heard elsewhere. And I sort of discovered that I had completely the wrong end of what neurodiversity was. I had been told or learned that neurodiversity is this umbrella term for a bunch of neurodevelopmental disorders and stuff. And it's about, yes, we are, rah, we might be broken, but we still deserve rights, blah, blah, blah. And of course, Judy quite quickly put me right. That neurodiversity is naming a power dynamic. It's naming an inalienable fact about humanity that no two people think alike. And it's also naming a power dynamic between a neurological majority who define what normal is and hold a lot of power, and neurological minorities who don't get to define that and generally don't hold power. And it's actually the same power dynamic as exists in racism and sexuality and gender and lots of other places. As Judy used to put it, it's a new category of the broader diversity model. So that kind of lens that neurodiversity is a type of power dynamic kind of feeds into that idea that the assumptions we make, the assumptions that are made, drive the barriers within society and within digital products. So for example, when we assume that everybody communicates a certain way, or when everybody focuses a certain way, or everybody perceives success in a certain way, we build those assumptions into day-to-day life. And then when somebody doesn't work that way, they get disabled by those assumptions and the barriers they've created. Kind of one of the phrases I use is this: I build my life around adventure and play. And what I mean by that is that I have sort of rejected the idea of work and life as two separate concepts. So this is building on this idea called monotropism. So monotropism is a bunch of different things, and I'll kind of hook it all back together in a tick. But the key lens for me is this idea about tunnels and flow states. So weirdly for me, the way that this came into my life was rather sudden. Back a couple of years ago, I suddenly had a pretty catastrophic illness and injury. I went into hospital for an infection. I came back out, and then over the course of about a week, I had trouble sitting up, standing up, walking, falling out of my chair, stuff like that. It was a pretty rough time, and I found myself spending 23 hours a day lying on my back staring at the ceiling. And suddenly I got more done than I got done in years. But I was in a lot of pain, but I was really productive. And what I was doing at the time is I was basically chatting and contacting every adaptive cycling organisation I could find in the UK. At the time, they believed I had a spinal cord injury. I'll come on to that in a tick. And around this time, shortly after this time, I actually attended the funeral online for a friend of mine, Dr. Dinah Murray, or Dina Murray. I knew her 11 years. Every time I said her name, she corrected me which way round it was, and I still can't remember. And they had this idea of monotropisms. This is the idea of people who have a handful of focuses that are very intense, and they get their best done in these long, flowy attention states. And that was me. And the thing is, when lying on my back 23 hours a day, I couldn't really worry about the washing up. I couldn't get to the washing up. Like, suddenly I had this simplicity in my life again. And with that simplicity, almost that childlike simplicity, I found myself getting into these wonderful flowy attention tunnels, getting more done than I could ever imagine, building side projects, doing all this communication. And I sort of looked at Dinah's work after her funeral and was like, oh, hang on a minute. Dinah's sort of describing this thing I'm experiencing, these flowy attention tunnels. So when I say to people I build my life around adventure and play, what I mean is that adventure and play are types of tunnels I have. So when I start my day, I don't start my day with a to-do list or a task list. I start my day deciding what I want to play with. Do I want to play with nerdy stuff? Do I want to make something? Do I want to do arts and crafts? Do I want to do something on the bike or do something on one of the trikes? I float around playing with things. And I also play with code. So I look after a piece of software that detects financial crime. I make accessibility things for people. A lot of that is playing. I write workshops and presentations and talks and come onto the podcast like these. These are all types of play. And then whenever I go outside, That's a heck of an adventure these days. It's very difficult to actually get outside. There's still a lot of challenges around my body and movement and things like that. An adventure might be going to the shops. It might be going for a bike ride. It might be, some days an adventure might be getting from my bedroom all the way to the lounge. By thinking about my life this way, in terms of the adventure and the play that I have, I'm leaning into those tunnels, leaning into those nice, flowy attention states. I don't really have any need for the concept of work and life. Some of the adventures I have get paid for, some of the play I have gets paid for, but that's not the important thing that demarks the two. So that's kind of what I mean when I say adventure and play. It's very different to the traditional Western approach to life, so to speak.
We were, just talking about work. So, beyond work, things being really accessible are an important part of your daily life, as you were just talking about your injury. So, what types of things have you found to improve the quality of your life as much as possible?
So going all the way back to that first question right at the start, that social model of disability, right? It's the mismatch between me and my environment that disables me. Way when back when all of this starting, I was working with a great trauma therapist who gave me the piece of advice of don't accept my injury, accept that my body will change. And it might be changing faster, it might be changing in more challenging ways than I was expecting. But all of our bodies are always changing. So that was kind of like the first part of it was accepting that my body will change. And then this social model lens of it's the mismatch between me and my environment that matters. So with that in mind, accessibility is critical because it's to look at my life and to find those barriers, those mismatches, and then engineer and iterate on solutions. So to give a couple of really good examples, back when I first had my injury and my life was suddenly very different, I knew I had to stay Jamie. And I know that's a really hard thing to try and explain, but who I was as myself had to remain intact, no matter what happened to my body. And in those first 100 days, I spoke to all these different adaptive cycling and bike companies. And I ended up building, buying, building, kind of creating this off-road trike. And one of my friends at the time said that the first time I rode it, the first time I tried one, he knew I'd be okay because I've always been, it's been my intensest of interest my entire life, building bikes, and riding bikes. So kind of very early in kind of like quality of life after my injury was getting back out on a bike and pushing into that. And then funnily enough, as my injury has progressed, as we've understood more about it, the doctors have literally told me, hey, if you hadn't done that, you'd have wasted away by now. So 2.5 years later, they're finally getting to some good answers about what's happened. And I still have a body that is able to recover. Whereas if I'd just taken the painkillers and the wheelchairs as the kind of the health service at the time suggested, I would have lost that movement. So in the end, we ended up doing all sorts of crazy cycling stuff. So that's one kind of tool, which is about what is me? What does it mean to be me? What do I need to be myself? The second thing is about sort of rejecting assumptions made by others around the norm. With my injury, I can't sit upright very much. That's one of the very hardest things I can do is to sit upright. Most wheelchairs have you sat upright. The wheelchairs that don't have you sat upright have you sat at this reclined thing on, like, your head's held up on this little pillow held on sticks. It is sensory hell. It is the most vulnerable, the most sensory overloading, horriblest, most thing I have experienced. And we looked at it and I was like, I don't want to go outside. I don't want to use this thing. It's horrible. And people were like, oh, you'll get used to it. And I was like, yeah, they said that about labels in my clothing. Didn't work that way. This is not the right thing. Rather than ignore my needs and say, oh, you'll just get used to it, all these barriers don't matter, we started chatting to people, we started chatting to different companies, and we found the buggy. So rather than having a wheelchair, I basically have a giant like toddler buggy. It's a three-wheel buggy, jogger style buggy, where it's got swivelly wheels on the front, depending on what wheels we put on it. It's a little bit longer than a normal wheelchair, a little bit narrower, but I'm sat down real low. They make a modification for mine to put skis on it, so you can shove it down a mountain if you want. It's stable, it doesn't fall over. It's like being cocooned in a nice little safe box. It's very comfortable. It's very cozy. It meets my sensory needs and my physical needs. And kind of one of the ironies is even before my issues with movement, I didn't go out all that much on my own anyway, because I sort of got hit by cars a bit too often. So it wasn't actually that much of a thing that it wasn't electric and I still needed help with it. Funnily enough, some of the friends and support folks have said they actually quite like it because I can't wander off anymore, which they're pretty big fans of. We were traveling through an airport not so long ago, A friend of mine was just like, look, for today, your luggage. Just leave me to it. Like, you're just luggage, and we'll get you to the plane. Don't worry about gates. Don't try and listen out for anything. Just trust someone else to deal with that. So that's kind of, the buggy's just an extension of that. When I'm in the buggy, I'm just luggage, and that's fine. Because generally speaking, almost always, they're going to the place I want to go anyway. So it's all good. So yeah, so it's about so much of the quality of life has come from iterating on what the barriers are and naming the barriers, but naming the barriers with clarity and not with a social lens. It's not that it's not that I'm hypersensitive to sound. I am just sensitive to sound. Hypersensitive, that's a nice judgmenty term, going back to that neurodiversity and power dynamics, that being able to say that the barrier that's going to disable me the most and cause my lowest quality of life is the fact that the wheelchair is awful for autistic people. It's just so badly designed. So rather than spend 3 years trying to make a bad thing better, let's go and find the right tool from the start and then carry our positive momentum through it, iterate on it, and get to where we need to go.
The phrase "you will get used to it" is, I wish that could be a phrase that would just go away, especially when we're thinking about accessibility. That is a very inaccessible phrase.
It's almost like the most pure form of the assumption that I make is stronger than my ability to listen to your experience, right? That's what's happening here. It is the very expression of a power dynamic. I will refuse to listen to what you're telling me because it is simpler in my life if I pretend that time will fix everything. Now, of course, there are some things we get used to over time, but if we support young people from the start to know their bodies, and half the reason I ended up with the injury I've got is because I didn't know my body well enough. I used to be traveling up the road to events, and I'd say to the support person, "Hey, these car seats are awful. Why has this car got such terrible seats?" Unknown to me, I had an injury right in the joint between the bottom of my spine and my hips, and I should have been going, "Ow, ow, 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 ow! Can I go to a hospital? Because this level of pain should not be tolerable." I was just like, yeah, I'm in like 8 out of 10 pain from these car seats. They must just be terrible car seats. I couldn't communicate how much pain I was in. I had gallstones and struggled to tell anyone because I'd spent years and years being told, oh, you'll get used to it. So I acclimatized to pain really quickly. And that actually was part of the root cause of how I ended up with the injury that I have and the way my health is. So yeah, that you'll get used to it. Totally agree. It's a very dangerous phrase.
Whatever our accessibility needs are, we all want to have wonderful experiences in our life. And you recently gave a very interesting presentation on how we can create these great experiences when we look at three important things, which are ability, capability, and capacity. What do you see as some of the subtle differences between these three concepts?
Okay, so this was a cool talk, and it kind of came from a kind of funny place. So, I don't know if you know David over at Assistive Ways. They create one of the AAC tools I use, which is called Proloquo for Text and Proloquo for Go. And they asked me to write a blog series for them or a blog post for them a while ago. And I said, oh, yeah, I'll talk about the subtlety between ability, capability, and capacity. So, I wrote the blog post, and it's up on their website as applied to AAC and communication, so assistive and augmentative communication. And then I have a friend who runs a digital accessibility conference focused on gaming called GA Conf, who basically said, can I have that but applied to games? So I made him a video, and I kind of learned how to make a video whilst making the video, which is a story all of its own right. The basic idea is that my abilities are the list of everything I'm able to do, which for me includes flying a small aircraft, right? If you put me at the controls of a Piper Warrior 2, 161 horsepower, I know what I'm doing. I can keep it in the air. I can fly it around. I don't have a private pilot's license, blah, 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 but I can fly the plane. Capability is the shorter list of what I can do like today. What am I capable of today? Generally speaking, my capability is driven by what the barriers are rather than necessarily what's in my body. So that's a much shorter list. And then my capacity is how many things I can do. So it might be that I'm capable of doing 20 things, but I have the capacity to do, say, two large things and one small thing or six small things. The reason it's a very subtle difference, right, between what we're able to do, what we're capable of doing, what we have capacity for. But it's really important for when things go wrong. So for example, if I'm unable to do a thing, then no amount of trying harder or energy is going to help because I need to learn a skill. when I'm struggling with something, when I encounter something I can't do, or a day goes wrong, I ask myself, am I unable? Am I incapable today? Or is it a capacity issue? If I don't have the ability, then I need to go learn a skill. And sometimes it's not worth me learning the skill, which is difficult to accept sometimes, but it is how it is. If I'm not capable, then there's probably a barrier that's in the way. I have the skill, but I just can't deploy it right now. So what's the barrier that's getting in the way of me deploying it right now? What can I potentially do around that? Is it an environmental barrier? Is it tools? Is it technology? Is it people? You know, like, for example, I'm not capable of flying a plane right now, partly because I don't have a plane and I don't have an instructor. So I'm not capable of flying a plane today. And then finally is capacity. That's the energy or the spoons. That's the last ingredient, which is, it doesn't matter if I've got the skills. It doesn't matter if I'm capable. If I don't have the energy, it ain't gonna happen. When I run out of energy, a lot of it is like, okay, I'm out of energy for today. I'm going to stop, rest, and come back to it tomorrow. I know it sounds like a bit of a woolly thing, but those three words, you know, is it an ability issue, a capability, or a capacity issue? They are how I navigate all sorts of barriers that I interact with, whether it's to do with my speech or to do with getting through a game or getting myself from here to the shops. Having a structured way to respond when things go wrong, to identify how it went wrong, without just saying the autism, is really critical. I don't know about you, but as far as I can tell, there are some people who believe there are five fundamental forces of nature: gravity, electromagnetism, the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, and autism. And you know, it's like that they're the things that make everything happen. I say to people, no, but often what people say, oh, the autism did X, and what they mean is the trauma that someone has built up because they're in an environment that has lots of barriers has led to, or the barrier in the environment to do with sound has led to. It's not the autism, you know. So that's one of the ways that I kind of break myself out of that cycle when I get into it.
You were talking a little bit about capacity, and these days, more than ever, I am thinking about that very subject, making the most out of the energy I have on a given day. So, in your presentation, I think you brought up a really important point in that when we start to run out of capacity, how do we end things smoothly or somewhat smoothly, doesn't come to a crashing halt? Are there signs that you're able to identify, at least sometimes, that you may be running out of your capacity?
Yeah, there are. So I sometimes say to people that pacing, which is, you know, making the most of my energy, is both an art form and a science. The arty for me bits are about learning to create the structures needed to achieve flow states in the first place. So the way that I bill my clients, I build them in spoons of energy. I don't build them in clock time on clock, because I can burn through five spoons in an hour or one spoon in 5 hours, depending on what I'm doing and how intense it is. So time on the clock makes no sense for me to bill in, so I bill in spoons. That's part of the art of pacing, right? It's about having spoons as this integral part of how I do things. It was another societal expectation that I had to push back on as I started to learn more about my body. So that's kind of like the art form part. There's a million details of how to do that. And then there's kind of like the sciencey part, which is it's a bit boring. It's writing things down and having a bit of data. I'm not that worried about the day-to-day data. It's the trends that I'm interested in. So if I'm looking at a thing and I'm going, hang on a minute, I'm down about 20% in spoons over the last 3 months, I should probably look into that and see if there's a pattern. And I might find that I've got a toothache, right? And it until I had something make me go, hey, I should check my body and just make sure the, oh yeah, when I brush my teeth, I'm crying. That probably tells me something, you know. There's kind of like the mixture of the art form of getting to know my body and the structures around me, and then the science of being able to write down some information. And so every morning I write down how many spoons I think I have. And then at the end of the day, I go, was my guess correct? And when I sometimes coach people with this or help people with this, I'll say, start off by just doing high, medium, low, or even just high, low. Over time, you will find your own scale. Some people have a 100-spoon scale. Some people have a 10-spoon scale. Some people are just high and low is enough. So that's kind of like another one of the techniques. And then finally, kind of like the wrapping things up and kind of getting in and out of tunnels. If I'm flowing through a nice tunnel, doing software development or building some slides or making something, and I'm aware that I'm starting to run out of capacity, I need to make it easy for me to pick it up again later. I don't know about you, but it's too easy. If you're not confident getting in and out of tunnels, and tunnels are a rare thing, as they used to be for me, I'll be up to 2 o'clock in the morning coding because I don't know when I'll be this productive again. I don't know when it will feel this good again. I don't know when it'll be this creative again. And as a kid, people would say, oh, you're obsessing. Actually, obsession has nothing to do with it. I'm in a tunnel and I'm in an environment that doesn't allow me to tunnel most of the time. So it's hard to leave that tunnel. As I've had more confidence getting into a new tunnel, I've also had more confidence ending up the tunnels that I've got. So when the back of my eyes start to hurt, when my speech starts going a bit wonky, when I can't say the entire alphabet, that's one that I'll sometimes do. If I go to say the alphabet and I pause, that normally tells me that I'm tired. These are all signs that I'm running out of capacity and it's time to wrap up the thing I'm doing. The other thing that I tend to do, just to make it a little bit easier, is I've got quite good at cutting things up into kind of Jamie Day chunked sizes. So by the time the task is sort of naturally finishing, I'm also naturally running out of energy as well.
I love that answer. And lastly, Jamie, how can our listeners learn more about you and the work that you do?
Gosh, so there's a few things. So first of all, most people know me as Jamie and Lion because, well, there's a 4 foot plush lion who goes everywhere with me and has done for some time. He's actually asleep in the other room at the moment. So this is one of the very rare occasions where he's not within arm's distance. So I'm just like Jamie and blank today. This doesn't feel right. So yeah, most people know me as Jamie and Lion, and you can find me at jamieandlion.com. I also keep a blog at spacedoutandsmiling.com. In fact, the reason I've got jamieandlion.com is because I have too many websites. So I built a website to put all my websites on rather than try and sort out all my websites. I also do quite a lot of podcasting. As I mentioned before, I've done some for the BBC. We did 4 series of the 1800 Seconds on Autism podcast, which can be found on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcast from, as we said 1,000 times during the recording. You can also find me on Twitter at Spaced Out Smiles, or just stick Jamie and Lion into the search engine of your choice, and you'll probably find something I'm up to.
Well, Jamie, it was wonderful getting to know you a little bit. Thanks so much for making time to join me today.
You're welcome. It's taken a bit of arranging, but we got there in the end.
Thanks so much to Jamie for the conversation. To learn more about Jamie, please check out the link in the podcast description for this episode. Here at Autism Personal Coach, our clients are the experts, our coaches are the guides. The majority of supports for autistics are not helpful. They try to fix us, not support us. That's why many are confused when we say our clients are the experts, experts of their lived experience. Our clients are the experts for what has worked for them and about the things that they need and want in their lives. Our coaches first listen to our clients and then ask thoughtful questions, offer resources, and strategize with our clients so they can get what they need to thrive. Would you want a guide in your life to coach you to get the things you desire? If so, then visit autismpersonalcoach.com for more information. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Autism Stories, and if you did, if you could tell a friend, foe, or anyone you know about it so they could have the same enjoyable and educational experience as you when listening to Autism Stories, it would be very much appreciated. Until next time, I'm Doug Bletcher of Autism Personal Coach. Talk to you then.